Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, we have a very special guest on the episode. His name is Georges Benjamin. He is the executive director at the American Public Health Association. Georges, thank you so much for coming on today's show.
Stephen, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's really a pleasure. I am just so impressed with the body of work that you have created in your career. Before we go too much into it, the organization, that work, do you mind just giving a brief background on your career in the medical field prior to becoming the leader and executive director at the American Public Health Association?
Sure, Stephen. You know, I grew up in Chicago. Really didn't have being a doctor on my mind at all, but I wanted to go to medical school to do molecular genetic research. Went to medical school, fell absolutely in love with clinical medicine. Also fell in love with emergency medicine. It was a new specialty at that time. So I went in the Army. I trained ultimately in internal medicine. And when I left my residency, I got assigned to one of the Army's emergency medicine training programs as faculty. So I got to teach emergency medicine, as an instructor. And I did that for several years. My last duty station was running the ER at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And then I got out and worked at the city hospital as running the ambulatory care division of a city hospital, which had the big, ER, trauma center, outpatient clinics, all that kind of good stuff. And was there about 2.5 years, and my phone rings and the mayor says, have I got a job for you? So I spent almost a couple years as the DC health commissioner in Washington, DC. Spent some time running the ambulance service in Washington, D.C., and then eventually ended up in Maryland as the deputy state health official for public health, and then the secretary of health for the state. And then as life goes on, new governor, new job, my governor was term limited. And so I looked around and I ended up at APHA, and what was supposed to be a kind of a couple year stint, I'm now in my 20th year.
That's awesome. Tell us, then what's kept you there? Why are you passionate about the work of APHA?
You know, APHA is a collective force. When you come to one of our meetings or you meet the people that are part of the public health community, you feel like you're at home. And so these are folks that are dedicated to the mission. They're all, when they get up every morning, all they care about is trying to make people healthy and trying to set the conditions so people can make good choices. So it's the mission, it's the work, it's really the people that are involved. And at the end of the day, we get a few wins too. You know, people do get healthier because of the work we do. And that's always a good thing.
That's awesome. I'd love it if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit more detail to sort of give context for listeners that may not be familiar with your organization, because it's quite remarkable that you've now celebrated your 150th year. The organization was founded in 1872. And when I think about the vast landscape of organizations across the country, there's not that many that have been able to have that continuity and, quite frankly, just stay in operation for that long. So do you mind giving us perspective on the origins, what maybe was going on in America 150 years ago? Why was the organization created? And how does it look? How is it maybe different today than it was 150 years ago?
Sure. As you said, 1872, you think that's shortly after the end of the Civil War. It's also the beginning of the environmental movement, where people begin to recognize that environmental conditions, things like poverty, lack of education, dramatically influenced your health. So people like a guy named Dr. Stephen Smith up in New York, and some nurses and some lawyers and some actually city planners, architects, engineers, recognize that the environment in which you live enormously influences your health. And so they got together and they began looking at what we call the social determinants of health and as ways to improve health. And they've been working for adequate nutrition, adequate health care, making sure people were treated appropriately, dealing with issues of discrimination, stigmatization, a whole range of early ideas. But a lot of it was really involved around sanitation, the sanitation movement as well. And then over the years, that has evolved into an organization which has been, quite frankly, the history of public health in our country. We've been involved in every single major decision on health, most of which were debated on the floor of our, what we call our governing council, which is our 200 member representative body. Let me just tell you about two quick stories. So number one, the debate about whether or not the nation ought to have a national board of health to advise the government, or whether or not we ought to have a department of health to handle health issues and be a policy body as well, was debated on the floor of our governing council. That's one interesting story. The second story is the fact that we were very much involved early on in both the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. Over the years involved with Medicare and Medicaid, we were very strong supporters of the need for Medicare when first conceived. So, you know, we've been involved in that policy space. At one point, we were this Association for the Americas. So that included our whole continent, North America, South America. And then over the years, other nations got their own associations. And so we have kind of shrunk our footprint, but we still have a huge international presence. And, you know, it's an organization that is involved with, we're 501c3, by the way. We're kind of a cross between a consumer group and a trade association. But we, you know, we're a society of people who want to improve the health of the public, and that's all you need to be a member of the association, is have that interest.
That's great. I'm curious to transition now about, you know, what's relevant over the past couple of years with the pandemic that we've been going to of most recent. My understanding, you know, kind of just in getting to know you and doing some research about the organization, is that going back over 100 years ago to approximately 1918, that your organization was the first to create, I think, what are referred to as vital records or death reporting. Curious how that might tie into, you know, what data and what things you were doing and collecting around the great pandemic of 1918, and then wondering if there's any overlay to like learnings or things that you all did as COVID was happening to like sort of learn from our past, or any comments you can sort of make around the pandemic of the 1900s to today.
Sure. So we were around in 1918. I think the first impact of the pandemic was, we actually moved our meeting, which was supposed to be in Chicago in the September-October timeframe. Mm-hmm. We moved it to later in the year, to December, to get out of the peak of mm-hmm. the pandemic. People didn't know about viruses, but we did understand it was some kind of respiratory spread. And we knew that social distancing as a concept was something that was important. So we tried to move our meeting outside that peak of it, but we felt we needed to meet and get together, because we needed to understand the science that was evolving around us. So we did have a meeting. We had almost, at that time, it was a big meeting for us, had over 1,000 people at that meeting. Our meeting now is 13,000-14,000 people.
Wow.
But at that meeting was a big meeting for us as we continued to evolve. And we met in Chicago, and they had big debates about the role of vaccines. Now, vaccines then was a vaccine against a bacterium, because the leading theory at the time was this bacterium called influenza, which caused lung pneumonia, was the cause of the disease. Turns out, of course, it wasn't. It was a virus, which ultimately got named influenza virus, that caused it. But there were these kind of abstract vaccines that were kind of rudimentary that people were using. And of course, the debate on our thing was, do they work? And the answer was, no, they didn't. We also debated mask wearing, which turns out, yep, it works. and we debated how to, you know, hand washing and things like that were debated on the floor of our governing council and in our scientific sessions. And a lot of that was published around that time. So I went back when COVID looked like it was coming, and went and pulled the journal and said, well, okay, what was society doing at that time? How did we respond to things? And then, of course, we tried to share that with colleagues around the country. I think over the years, we've been involved in things that you mentioned, setting up the first vital record systems, promoting the first, even though it was started in Maryland, checking children for genetic diseases, we promoted it very actively. So when every baby who's born, we take a little of blood from the umbilical cord, and that gets us off looking for genetic diseases. So you can inform the parents about genetic diseases. And we were big proponents of that early on. I think if you look at our history, we've had our meeting in lots of places. We've had it in Canada. We've had it in Mexico. We had it in Cuba twice in the early 1900s.
Wow.
One of the things that came out of our Cuba meeting was a book called Standard Methods for Water and Wastewater. And it is the book that every laboratory in the world uses to do the scientific tests on your water to rule out problems with your water. So your water isn't clean, I jokingly say, until APHA says your water is clean, based on the diagnostic test. It's a big book. It's a kind of big book stop, a doorstop book.
Looks like it's on its 23rd edition.
It's
originally published in 1905. I just pulled it up.
You got it. And we do it with two other amazing associations, which go back to, remember I said that we were kind of a multidisciplinary founding?
Sure.
So the other two organizations is the group that is very much involved in testing your water, and the engineers that are involved in making sure the pipes are appropriate so your water can go through. So we have multidisciplinary partnerships even today that are legacy activities.
That's amazing. That's great to hear. I don't know a ton about, you know, clean water and the wastewater, sure, but I was watching a video most recently, and it was talking about, you know, the planning of it in cities and urban planning and everything. And whoever the gentleman, I think this was in London, when they put in all of their sewer systems, they scoped it out, and the engineers reported the size, and whoever was the head of it said, double it. We only want to do this once. So they doubled the capacity for everything just to kind of try to plan for the future of all the pipes and sewer lines and whatnot.
Well, we call, you know, today we would call that smart growth. It's about urban sprawl. We want to make sure people are reusing the infrastructure and to stop us continue to grow out cities.
Yeah.
You know, now there's this tendency to now rehabit the cities that we live in. So we update them, we modernize them. I think I'm glad we modernized them. The only concern I have is that we push out the endogenous people that are already there,
mm-hmm.
You know, and those folks, where do they go? And quite frequently they get pushed out to the suburbs where we have not rebuilt the infrastructure. And then they have to come back to the central city for jobs, which means they need a car, or they need a transportation system like a train system to get back in, which means they have to make enough money to be able to afford both of them. And quite frequently, those individuals don't make enough money if you're going to, you know, be a waitress, or you're going to be a food service worker, or a janitor, work on the cleaning staff of a hotel. Quite frequently, you just don't have the money. You're not paid enough to live way out there without any services. And so we've got to do a better job of building our communities.
I couldn't agree more. I live in, born and raised not far from where you all office in DC. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, but I've lived in Austin, Texas for the past 12 years. And we've been facing just a huge crisis with homelessness here and lack of affordability, and just the stratification between it's not even the haves and the have nots, but it's like people that, you know, are actually earning, like, by all accounts, a reasonable salary, you know, can barely keep up with the rising apartment rent. So it's really, I mean, what you're talking about is so true and is top of mind for me. I'm curious, as we talk about this too, what role does APHA play in assisting or advising, you know, other developing countries or other kind of sister organizations? Because I imagine that, you know, there's other, you know, APHA, like, sort of equivalents out there, you know, run by other countries. So, sure. And yeah, because especially as we're talking about, it's interesting, and I'm kind of rambling on here, but it's always interesting to think of the challenges within the US, and we have many. But then obviously I think about it from a global and international perspective, and have been, you know, always just opens my eyes to the challenges that a lot of other countries face that, that we have actually already overcome here in America.
No, absolutely. So funny you should ask. So just today, the annual meeting of the World Federation of Public Health Associations met. So all of the national associations around the world have a society called the World Federation. Today was their annual meeting, and I represent the U.S. on that governing group. But for many years, for almost its first 40 years of existence, APHA was the secretariat, meaning we ran it. And then it's now been spun off. It's their headquarters are in Geneva. They partner with the World Health Organization as a what we call an organization that's in official relations with the World Health Organization. And so we, we're part of that. And so, yes, there are nations, you know, Britain, Ethiopia, Chile, Cuba, you know, Canada, Brazil in our part of the world. And you have China has a public health association. Taiwan has a public health association. And we partner with all those groups, not only to try to strengthen our own activities in our own nations, but also to share ideas around the world. And we've been doing a lot of work in making sure that we enhance the vaccination effort, dealing with misinformation and disinformation. One of the big issues right now is trying to build a robust adult vaccination program, because all of us have focused so much on kids, which is important. We've kind of ignored adults. And so adult vaccination levels are generally not well subscribed. And we need to all do a better job of that.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Because I thought about the initial, at least in the US, the rollout of the vaccine, you know, went initially to, frontline workers, and then, you know, elderly people. And then we sort of like scaled down in ages. You know, I had to wait months to get mine because I was, you know, in my 30s. And then, you know, finally the FDA worked it through for kids to get it. So what do you mean by, you know, kind of?
Well, right now, if you're a kid, in our nation, you are required to have in every jurisdiction, a series of childhood vaccines for measles, mumps, chickenpox, etc.
Understood.
Okay. And we have put in place a regulatory structure and a funding structure to make sure that's possible.
Yep.
But if you're an adult, if you're an adult, we don't have a structure or a regulatory structure for a flu shot. We didn't have one for COVID. We don't have one for a tetanus shot. You know, you get it every 10 years because of your tetanus shot every 10 years because it's recommended. But if you don't have health insurance, there's not a mechanism to make sure that everybody gets an adequate tetanus shot.
Understood.
So when COVID came, it was a new vaccine purchased and basically by the government. Mm-hmm. And so delivering it the way we did was a national strategy based on how much vaccine we had and who was most at risk. So healthcare workers and people in nursing homes were most at risk. So that's what we focused on that.
Yeah.
While we did that, we built up the infrastructure of state and local governments so they could then give those mass vaccination campaigns we saw them doing. And our challenge now is how do we keep that infrastructure in place or create a mechanism for a standby capacity so that, let's say, we have a big outbreak in the fall, we can reopen those mass vaccination clinics and have the actual vaccine on hand to deliver it.
I'm not sure if you're going to know this statistic, but what was sort of frustrating for me is that for the past, 12 years or so, I've been fortunate to have a primary care doctor in Austin. And they, of course, have, you know, my medical records and whatnot, and those of, you know, all of their patients. So my thought was that they should have been given doses and then they could have, you know, been in administration instead of me. Why was the thought, was it from a scale? I mean, why not just go to the primary care doctors that already have the contact information of all the patients. They could reach out, they could coordinate it.
It was a practical problem. Initially, the vaccine, you may remember, required ultra cold storage.
Okay.
And so most doctors didn't have a refrigerator that could cool to minus 40 degrees.
Got it.
The second thing was it came in lots of several thousand. Mm-hmm. So most doctors needed 20 or 30 doses. So until they crafted the system to be able to get smaller lots to the doctors.
Yep.
And we learned over time that how much storage the vaccine needed, how best to defrost it and train everybody to do that so we didn't have vaccine wastage. It took us several months to get that straight. But once we did, we could then give it to the primary care docs. By the way, now that we built the infrastructure, when we start giving the shots to kids, it's more likely that the kids are going to get their shots through their pediatrician, particularly those that are five and under.
Got it. Excellent. Excellent. I'm curious too, like, you know, your perspective. This is just coming up as we're chatting. So I want to be respectful of sort of if or how you want to answer the question or not. But in my limited understanding of, you know, supply chain as it relates to PPE, you know, obviously when COVID hit, there was such a demand and such a shortage of PPE equipment. And then domestically in the US, many companies, you know, sprung up and built factories or transitioned their machinery and their workforce to produce this. And then we had a drop off as things started to, you know, get better over the past year, 6 months, whatever you want to call it. And then lately, what I've been seeing is that we're having a shortage of PPE and where China is saying that there's challenges in getting it to us. What's actually going on there? And why not create more, ways for PPE businesses to be on standby or stay in business domestically?
Yeah, we've had several things have happened in the world. Obviously, the world's become more globalized. Businesses have become a lot more consolidated. So, for example, we have this food shortage for babies right now.
Yes.
Or infant formula. And that's because we've allowed the industry to consolidate. We've moved as a society to just-in-time ordering.
Yes.
You know, as a way of cutting costs and the fact that we could do it. It may not have been wise to do it, but we could do it. So right before the pandemic hit, I was actually at a meeting in the end of January and of health executives. And we were having a conversation, one of those, you know, those coffee table conversations during a break about the shortage of protective gear like gowns and gloves. So pre-pandemic, we were having shortage problems already. Then the pandemic hit, and the whole world needed the same commodity at the same time. And of course, everybody went to look at both their primary supplier and their secondary suppliers. And it turns out they were all the same people. People were going to the same folks and we didn't have a supply. By the way, this was not a new problem. We knew this problem existed. We've known it existed for many years. It just hadn't been fixed. So in a globalized world, we've got to figure out how we rebalance the supply lines. And this just was a PPE problem, you know, personal protective gear problem. But the problem of having just the raw materials to make the vaccine, raw materials to make the antiviral agents, continues to be a problem. So I know the Biden administration and the Trump administration before that began using this Defense Production Act rule and law to be able to incentivize businesses to go to enhance new products and continue to do so. But we really do need a strategic plan on how we're going to keep these systems in place so they can pivot when we need them. You know, the vaccine companies were able to do this and create this vaccine in record time only because the federal government committed to them. They would pay for the product, they would pay for the research, they would pay for the product, and it would pay for its distribution. Now they've got to transition that product to the private sector and build kind of a permanent infrastructure to do that, because there were some companies that stopped producing some commodities to make those vaccines and other therapeutic agents. And unless the government does that off of some kind of strategic plan, we're going to find ourselves short of what we need in the future. Just like we found out that we don't have enough supply of baby food. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, the administration, I believe, has hopped on that pretty quickly. Once it became apparent, it was a big problem. Some would argue they were still a little late in getting started. But I think once they figured it out, it was a big problem. They've jumped all over it. The problem is, how do they fix it for the long haul? Because we should never, ever not have adequate food for babies in this country.
And so to that point, like coming back to the role of APHA and all of your, membership base and everybody that's both the staff and board and doctors and everyone that looks to APHA, how does it practically work? I mean, if as an organization, you all see these challenges, is there a direct conduit to government, and what's sort of that process like? I mean, do you have relationships with certain Senate or House committees that are focused on these topics?
Sure, absolutely. So we're guided by a series of policy policies that big governing council I told you about. Mm-hmm. We have a group of people that write these policies. They're vetted like scientific papers. And then we go through a policy process for them to get approved. And so you go to our website, you see a repository of over 1,000 policies sitting there, which basically say, we think these are our principles. And then my staff and I use those principles when a problem comes up, hopefully before that problem comes up, to both advocate through government by sending letters, banging on doors, having forums where we educate people about the problem and some of its solutions. And we do that in a way that both engages and informs both government and other organizations. Some we do in partnership, some we do in competition with. So we don't technically lobby per se, but we do advocate for these things to happen. And we push very hard. So we bring together groups, for example, to say, the CDC's budget, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's budget, was X amount of money last year. And we think CDC needs more money. And so they need so much more money. And we bring together a group to consider what is a rational number to ask for. And then we send, these over 100 groups out to Congress and to the administration to say, we think this year, the president's budget ought to grow, ask for X amount of money for CDC. And we then go to Congress and say, and you ought to support X amount of money for CDC. Now, all those organizations then go in and say, and you ought to give it all to us. but then that's okay. There's a competitive process there. But our role is helping decide how big the growth should be and what our recommendations should be. And we're pretty dogged on that. We write, call, get in front of the media, demand that it happens. And then when something goes wrong because they didn't invest in what we suggested they invest in, we're there to say, we told you so.
Love it. I think it's great. It's that's so cool. I think I actually feel a lot more relieved just about things, in the world and obviously in the US and America, hearing you share this and the role you play. As we start to round out this interview, I want to focus on some of the more operational side of things. At Charity Charge, we work with a couple thousand organizations, and we're always trying to educate those leaders of different nonprofits on the importance of financial stability. So this is, again, a really rare case to have the pleasure of interviewing someone that's leading an organization that's over 150 years old. Plus, you've been with the organization for 20 years. So I'm curious, what advice would you give to someone running an organization? Maybe they're just getting started with it and they aspire to be around for 20 years or 150 years. What are the things you would suggest to them to be able to run an organization, then become financially stable, grow, and continue to be in business and operation for years to come?
Yes, in general, we try to be fiscally conservative. We try to have multiple revenue streams. Multiple revenue streams are important. And we try to live within our resources each year. Now, COVID has stressed it. And one of the reasons you have reserves is so that you can go into them when times are hard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, last couple of years, we've had to go into reserves a little bit because times are hard. But we're able to do that because every year we were able to take any surplus revenues that came in and put them in the bank. Right. So having a good savings account is important. But I also think it's important that people figure out what's important for you to do and focus your mission and then put your resources behind what a focused mission is. Quite frankly, if it hurts people, it kills people, the public health community has a role in it. But we can't solve all the problems. So we try to solve those problems directly, the ones that we think are important for us to take on and address. And then we partner with others who have the strength to do certain things. And we don't really care who gets the credit. We care that the mission gets done. And so we try to hold ourselves accountable to the mission getting done. And we do that either directly or through partnerships. And, you know, quite frankly, like many organizations, we can always use donations. You know, a lot of folks think that there's 1,000 people under our roof. There are 75 on my staff. We have about depending on the year, a $16 to $18 million budget. But I have to raise that basically from zero every year.
What are the biggest buckets of sources of revenue for the organization?
Our annual meeting, which is about 40% of our revenues, but it's a big expose, but it's about, 13 to 14,000 people attend that meeting.
Yep.
That's one thing. We have a journal, the American Journal of Public Health, and a small book company. So our publications basically pay for themselves. We have to subsidize them from general revenues every now and then, but basically they cover their own costs. The journal is the top journal in the field. And so people are very much interested in publishing in our journal. We have some grants and contracts. So we do apply for grants and contracts. And we have donations. We get donations from philanthropy, from some of the foundations around. Some of our funders, the Kellogg Foundation, the Robert Johnson Foundation, the Kresge Foundation, the Beaumont Foundation has been a big funder of us over the years. The Skoll Foundation fairly recently. And there's a foundation called the CDC Foundation. So the point is, we get some dollars from them. And then, of course, membership dues.
Yep.
We're a membership association. And, you know, we encourage people to join us as members. It's if I can give them the website, it's www.apha.org. Please go to that website and see what we do. And, you know, there are many ways to partner with us, even if you're not a member.
Well, and to that end, I know that one of your initiatives is the Speak for Health campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we created this campaign called Speak for Health to galvanize what we call Generation Public Health. So Generation Public Health is anybody that wants to be engaged with us. If you're a paid member, unpaid member, supporter, funder, whatever, you're part of Generation Public Health. In other words, you're part of our listserv. And we encourage those folks to engage with us through social media, through responding to email alerts, advocacy alerts, where you send a letter to Congress to say, we believe this should happen in Congress. And it's really an effort to try to advance in a rapid way, in a large way, the health and well-being of the public. We don't have a lot of personal pocketbook issues. Mm-hmm. Generally, our advocacy issues are fund this, do this. It's in your best interest to do that. And we do a lot of trying to engage the average citizen and empower the average citizen to control the health and well-being of their community. And we think if we have put the public back into public health through Speak for Health, then we've been successful.
That's awesome. I'm so glad you came on as a guest today for this episode. I found this just so personally fascinating. I know everyone listening is really going to enjoy it, because what you're doing, quite frankly, is just so unique, you know, as an organization, and obviously is so relevant. You all have been doing this for 150 years on behalf of, you know, all these citizens in America. And obviously, you know, you're having an impact globally. But I think people are even more in tune to it, obviously, with what's happened the past couple of years with COVID. So I just personally want to thank you for being a leader and dedicated to improving public health in America. It's remarkable.
Oh, Stephen, listen, thank you very much for the opportunity to spend some time with you. And I keep reminding folks, it ain't me. It's all the people behind me, all my staff, all of our members, and quite frankly, the public that really cares about their neighbors.
Well said. We'll end on that note. For everyone that was here to listen along, I want to mention again, if you're interested in getting involved, supporting, being a member of APHA, you can simply go to apha.org. For this episode of the Charity Charge Show, we had Georges Benjamin, Executive Director at the American Public Health Association. Look forward to seeing you on another episode. Take care.